for those kinds of small businessmen. And I mean, we're really, when I think about my mission, it's really about helping to create jobs.
Okay.
Really helping to build a strong economy, particularly in rural areas.
Yeah.
But around kind of growing things and looking for opportunities for people to make money with growing, whether it's growing tomatoes or growing oysters out here in Prince William.
Mariculture.
Yeah, mariculture in Prince in southeast and Prince William Sound, Kachemak Bay, all across Alaska's coast, or growing peonies, which is a booming new industry. Peony is a flower, but I can digress here a minute on peonies if you're interested. But
sure.
It turns out peonies is this beautiful kind of big flower, big stem, big tall and a big single stem, beautiful flowers, very fragrant, and they're very popular for weddings. So, but they generally bloom. Where they're grown, they generally bloom around May.
Mm.
And it turns out a lot of people get married in, like, June.
Yeah.
And July.
True.
And there's not very many places around the world where you can grow a peony that blooms in June and July. So happens that Alaska is one of those places where that's when they bloom.
Nice.
So there's kind of a global market gap and a market niche that Alaska can fill. So farmers around Alaska are just starting to realize that this is a potential new industry. In the Kenai Peninsula, Homer, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Matsu, a number of farmers are starting to grow peonies. It takes 3 or 4 years before they mature, so it's really kind of been just now starting to get to the point where we're growing enough peonies to fill that global demand. But it's a pretty exciting new industry. So anyway,
it's
one of the things that we help support this primarily by providing loans. So the Farm Service Agency, there's kind of two different kind of parts of the programs that we provide. One is a set of loan programs.
Mm-hmm.
And the loans are the reason that we're involved in the loan business at all is because banks in Alaska and in a lot of places are not that comfortable making loans to these kinds of businesses.
Okay.
Whether it's they're kind of risky. You know, a farmer, things happen.
Flowers,
you have weather, you have prices. It's not a good loan for a lot of banks, particularly now with tight credit. Mm-hmm. They're not making loans. And so really, the government got into this to fill that kind of market failure that the banks weren't providing loans. So, Congress decided, that's a good idea. We think it's important that we have farmers in this country, that we're growing our own food and providing some food security. Now, if you look across the country, we actually grow 85% of the food that Americans eat.
We do? In the United States?
Yeah, in the United States. We also do a lot of export to other countries. So we decided it's a good idea to support, make sure that we've got farmers growing food here in the United States. You know, you could say, that's a big global market. We don't care where we get our food from. We get it from China. We get it from Mexico. No big deal. But actually, food is one of those things I think you do want to grow it close to home.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what if for some reason the imports don't come in? And Alaska is actually very different than the rest of the lower 48. We are not very food secure.
Okay.
We don't grow or produce
much
of the food that we eat.
Well, my next question was about comparing the Farm Service Agency here to other states and how it's different.
It's different because, some people say to me, you work for the Farm Service Agency. We don't really have a lot of farms in Alaska, do we? What do you do? But we actually do have over 1,000 farms. in Alaska. They range from small, you know, 1 or 2 acres up to thousands of acres,
wow.
Large farms up in the Delta area. We don't produce enough food to feed Alaskans.
Mm-hmm.
We used to. Actually, mm-hmm. I was coming in from the airport, and I remember as you drive by Old Dairy Road.
Yeah.
Why do you think
never
it was called Old Dairy Road?
Because milk.
We used to have dairies. There were dairies in the Southeast. And back in 1955, Alaskans actually did produce quite a bit of the food we ate here. And I was looking at some old data about this, and in 1955, 55% of the food that we ate here in Alaska was produced in Alaska.
Half of it, wow.
Was grown. Yeah, over half of it was grown here. And now the estimates are somewhere around 5%.
Wow.
So 95% of the food we eat comes from somewhere else.
It's got a high cost of transport. It's expensive.
Yeah, so what are the implications of that? You know, how does it make us feel about what would happen in the case of a disaster, if the planes stopped flying?
Mm-hmm.
How many days of food would there actually be on the shelves? Not that many. So if you're going to deal with that issue of emergency preparedness in case of disaster, you might want to think about strategies that involve growing and producing more of our own food right here at home.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, as I said, we think about my job is really about creating jobs, and there's a lot of opportunity for small businesses to start a business related to growing food. Because I don't know about you, but I hear a lot of people talk about how they'd like to buy fresh, local food, but they can't find it.
Organic.
So, yeah, I think the demand is there. So I think if someone got into the business here in Juneau, got a high tunnel. You know what a high tunnel is?
No.
A high tunnel, it's like a greenhouse.
Okay.
The difference between a high tunnel and a greenhouse is a greenhouse, you can put heat into it, put a stove and warm it up. But a high tunnel is just some kind of sometimes they call them hoop houses because they are often shaped like an old Quonset hut and that round, looking long and round like a tunnel almost.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but basically it's a covered area, and within that covered area, the air temperature gets warmer, the ground soil gets warmer, and so in a climate like Alaska that's kind of cool, it warms it up, and so the crops and plants grow a lot better.
So you could grow anything if you had a high tunnel.
I don't know that you could grow bananas.
Okay, well, maybe not that.
But you could grow a lot more in a high tunnel than you could just without it. You know, you wouldn't have that influence of the wind and cool weather. I think with the proper kind of growing techniques like using a high tunnel, you could grow a lot of things here, right here in Juneau, or all across Alaska, and make some money at it, and provide a service to your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's another reason. When you think about if 95% of the food that we eat is coming from outside, that means there's a pipeline of money. Our money
leaving. That's
just going outside.
Mm.
If we could keep more of that money right here in Juneau, right in our own communities, what would the multiplier effect be?
Mm.
Then you need suppliers, you need transportation, you start putting people to work around what people are now calling a food system.
Okay, not like
they're
farmer's market?
They sort of look at it like when I first started this job, I had worked on a lot of different issues across Alaska. I got here back in 1969, and I've done a lot of different things from working on the pipeline, fighting forest fires, commercial fishing, building cabins, working in the legislature. Yeah. So I really hadn't done much around agriculture. So it was new to me when I took this job a few years ago. And so I'm now starting to realize people don't think of it as just as agriculture. They think of it as food. And there's a lot of talk, you know, about like a watershed. You say, well, this is our area. This is our watershed.
Yeah.
Well, people are talking about food sheds.
Huh.
Like, this is our area. This is where our food comes from, in our food shed. And when you think about the Juneau food shed, some of it involves fish, crab, deer, you know, hunting, fishing. Mm-hmm. We're getting our food in our area. But the more you think about your food shed, the more aware you are of your dependency on food coming from outside of your food shed and what the advantages would be of building a stronger food shed or a stronger food system, what the benefits would be economically, what the benefits would be in terms of security, and what the benefits would be in terms of health. You know, what you look across Alaska and you see the health statistics with like obesity problems,
diabetes.
These are all food related, heart disease, cancer.
Access to good food, right?
Yeah. And so how do you sort of start to solve those problems? Right. One strategy is to think about helping improve the access to healthy food. If there's no healthy food around, people won't eat it. Then, you know, they also talk about food deserts. Have you ever heard that term?
No, all those new terms.
food desert is really a term that they use when they talk about the inner city often, where they say there are some neighborhoods where all there is like a 7-Eleven and small, there's no real grocery stores.
You get packaged preservatives.
Yeah. So how do you, you can't even really get, you don't have access to, as you say, healthy food. So, yeah, look at Alaska. You can really, actually, a lot of Alaska is, in a way, a food desert. In a way, you know, our access to subsistence kinds of foods is pretty good. Hunting, gathering kind of things. But even in the bush, their food system is a combination of hunting, gathering, and store-bought. You know, people go to the store. And so when you walk into the store and there's no fresh vegetables, what are you going to buy? So if we're interested in kind of improving some of the health outcomes in Alaska, you might want to think about.
Well, and the Alaska Food Policy Council is what you serve on, Danny, or you play a role in this council, right? What are the objectives of this group? Is that part of what they're doing?
So when I first took the job, I really was trying to wrap my arms around this idea of agriculture and food, and started looking at the sort of holistic way of looking at a food system, where our food comes from. And I realized that there were groups in the lower 48 and in other states and in local communities called food policy councils. And it turns out a food policy council is an organization or a group of people who all have some kind of connection or some interest in food. So it's a way of kind of bringing the farmers together with the fishermen, together with like the food banks who are interested in serving the hungry, to the schools who are serving school lunches, to hospitals, to state and federal agencies who are involved in regulating, like food safety.
Yeah, definitely.
So we're kind of bringing all these people together and looking at our food system and kind of trying to work together to solve those problems. So like a food bank, their interest is making sure people are being fed. The farmer, he's more interested in making a living, producing food. But if you get all those people in the same room, there are opportunities to kind of brainstorm together about how to solve problems. And so I thought that makes a lot of sense for Alaska, how to, maybe we should, if it's such a big problem in a sense, how are we going to become more food secure? How are we going to produce more of our own food, get healthier, create jobs? How do you do it?
Yeah.
How did we get here in the first place from back in the 50s when we were producing a lot of our own food and now it's all being flown in? How do we get back to that, or how do we? It's not an easy question. So the Food Policy Council is really a place where people can get together, you know, kind of look at what the challenges are, mm-hmm. and work together towards some solutions, and then work with policymakers. Policymaker could be state legislature, mm-hmm. could be the governor, could be Congress.
You guys.
USDA, exactly.
I'm sure.
Try to come up with some solutions. So that's the group I'm working with. We recently developed a strategic plan. We came up with some goals and strategies. I'm just going to flip through this strategic plan. The goals are related to, as you said earlier, having one goal is all Alaskans should have access to affordable, healthy, preferably local foods. That's a goal.
Great.
Okay. How do you
the
get there?
The council set that goal.
Yeah, the council set that. We talked and we said, that's something. Why are we here? What do we want to try to do? That's what we want to try to do. That's one goal. Another one has to do with work, with jobs. So, well, we should have food-related industries that are, you know, strong workforce. We got people trained. We have a supportive business environment to help small businesses. So it's sort of a small business goal. We could create businesses and help them. Another goal is related to our system being more sustainable. Like, can we produce more? Can you see this, like, for the future, that we're actually going to have more food?
Mm.
Another goal is related to just getting people involved. That goal five says Alaskans should be more engaged in our food system, more aware, a better understanding of where our food comes from. Should we help our kids understand where a carrot comes from? Be more sort of connected to our food, not so disassociated from. So we set these goals. We set some strategies and some ways of getting there, and we're working now on kind of more of like an action plan. Okay, what are we going to do, and who's going to do it, and how are we going to do this, and what are the solutions? But it's a great group of people, and they all kind of realize that they're better off working together than they are working by themselves. That it's a kind of a coalition concept. That hey, if we all get together.
Maybe
we can get somewhere.
Well, the state's hard to get together, though, right? I mean, is it pretty Anchorage-centric and the valley?
Well, no, it's not, actually. We've got people from Barrow to Ketchikan who are involved. We do a lot by teleconference.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's
and we talk on the phone. And a lot of people are doing things in their own community. I mean, right here
I saw your take
in Juneau, one of the guys on the Food Policy Council is here in Juneau. He's been very active. Is Darren Snyder. And Darren, I saw Darren today, and he was telling me about the Juneau Chicken Summit. Have you heard about this?
Cluco
de Mayo. So, Saturday, there's going to be an opportunity to hear from local chicken owners, experts, about if you're ever interested in raising your own chickens in your backyard, how to do it, what the regulations are. So, if you're
interested,
come on.
Here in Juneau, some friends had their chickens killed by like a bear or a lynx. There's some real issues here that probably aren't present anywhere else in the
world. Well, other places. A friend of mine had chickens. Said he woke up one morning, looked out the window, there was a bear walking by with a chicken in his mouth.
Oh, God.
Yeah, or birds, hawks and
eagles.
Yeah, we have our unique challenges, but I think Alaskans are pretty pretty smart, pretty adaptive, and we're pioneers, and I think we can figure this stuff out.
True. Now, for that policy council, you have a blog as well. People can check it out, right, if they're interested.
Yeah, Alaska food policy. .blogspot.
Okay.
I think you can Google
just
it.
Google Alaska Food Policy Council. I think it comes up because, yeah, yep. The blogspot might not have been right when you said it to
yeah,
me.
Okay.
Anyway.
So, yeah, that's a good place to get information about what we're doing. We have a listserv, so if you're interested in just kind of getting on our mm-hmm. listserv, a lot of information goes across there about resources, about ideas, about
yeah.
grant opportunities,
yeah.
Where you can get information, answer questions. If you're interested in doing stuff on your own, in your backyard, or in your community,
mm-hmm.
Community gardens they're great because not only do they help produce food,
yeah.
but they bring people together. Sure. They really help build communities.
Yeah.
You know, Michelle Obama...
She's been working on this issue, right?
She's got a garden in the back of the White House. I think one of the reasons she did that was to kind of highlight the health ideas, say, hey, we can be healthier. We can help take care of ourselves. We can grow our own food. And, so my boss, the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, when he saw Michelle Obama do that, he said, maybe I should do that, too, over at the Department of Agriculture. So he tore up this parking lot, planted a big garden over there on the other side of the Washington Mall.
Cool.
And he called it the People's Garden. And he called it the People's Garden because the Department of Agriculture is actually celebrating right now its 150th anniversary. It was started... President Lincoln signed the legislation forming the Department of Agriculture in 1862, and President Lincoln called it the People's Department.
Nice.
Because back then, like 50% of Americans lived on farms.
A lot more than now, yeah.
Yeah. But it's still an interesting department. It still touches a lot of Americans in a lot of different ways.
Uh-huh.
And so we now have People's Gardens. So that... People's Garden that he started in Washington, they've now started to spring up all around the country. We started one in front of our office in Palmer. We now have a little vegetable garden. And there's something like 200 or 300 or 1,000, I think, People's Gardens all around the country now. So Juno should have a People's Garden.
Hey, Bruce Patello. That's your... challenge to start a people's garden here. Well, the Sunday Market is actually another project that goes on here in Juneau, and they've been trying to do a weekly kind of farmer's market on Sundays and not only promote agriculture produce, but artisan, handcrafts and honey. And
farmer's markets are growing around the country and in Alaska. And Alaska actually is one of the fastest growing by percentage. Alaska's farmer's markets over the last 5 years grew more than anywhere. The numbers of markets across Alaska have grown faster than anywhere in the country.
That's impressive.
And they are really booming. There's 2 or 3 or 4 of them in Anchorage. We actually had a Wednesday market all winter in the mall, in the Sears Mall in Anchorage, every Wednesday.
Yeah.
Some of the produce that was stored over the winter, like potatoes, carrots and beets and rutabagas and turnips, they'd bring them in at the Wednesday market. They're great. They're fun. We actually play music at one of the farmers markets, the South Anchorage Farmers Market in Anchorage. Go out there on Saturdays. People have a good time. They love to talk to the farmers.
Yeah,
and
right.
You can, right this time of year, you can go out and buy little plants, starts. Baskets.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Farmers markets are a great way for people to get food.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are out of time. I didn't even get through 2 questions with you, but it was wonderful to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks.
Danny Constantine, he is State Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Service Agency in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're going to leave you with a quick song by Buena Vista Social Club, Chinchinerrero. And stay tuned. In the next half hour, I'll be talking to Linnea Osborne and Carl Broderson about the upcoming Blessing of the Fleet. Stay tuned.
And I will follow you everywhere you go.
Alaska Identity Project, KTOO News, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned in the second part of the show. Thanks to Danny Constantine, State Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Service Agency and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He did a great job talking about the issue of community as well, Linnea, and the importance of food and food security in Alaska, and great issues there. Hopefully he'll come back on the show in the future. In this half hour, I'll be speaking with Linnea Osborne and Carl Broderson. Linnea is one of the five original Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial Board members. She's married to a commercial fisherman, 50 years of experience. They currently own the F.V. Mongoose, and they operate it in several fisheries around Southeast Alaska. She's an accountant with the state and has previously served on the CBJ Harbor Board, CBJ Fisheries Development Committee, and over 10 years on the Juneau Douglas F&G Advisory Committee. She's also been a Girl Scout leader for a few years, and her daughter at JDHS has been involved in the annual blessing, both on their boat and previously as a Girl Scout. Carl Broderson is an aspiring power troller and one of the newer ACFM, which is Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial, board members, having joined just this year. His father was a troller longliner starting in the 80s, and his grandfather was a troller for more than 65 years. His uncle, mother, and grandmother should all be mentioned as well, since everyone in the family helps get fish on a plate, not just the person with the permit. Once in college, Carl crewed multiple king openings with his grandfather, and the seasickness got better by small increments each time. A famous show. He is on the board of the Juneau Youth Sailing and a volunteer with several organizations, which one we serve on together, the Juneau World Affairs Council.
Woo-hoo.
Yay! Had a great talk last night by Kathy Kelvin. She's the CEO of the UN Foundation.
Excellent.
So, Linnea and Carl, welcome to the show. Thanks for
Thank you for having the time.
A timely topic with the blessing of the fleet this Saturday.
Yeah, also a nice segue from food security to fishing.
Yeah, well, actually, the fishing is included in that as well.
Oh, yeah. They sit together very well. It's like you planned it.
Big way.
Well, people think ag and they think agriculture and they think farms. They don't necessarily include ocean. But anyway, so let's start just by talking about what is going on this weekend. But what the ACFM, this Fisherman's Memorial, is, or if it's an organization or a...
So Alaska Commercial Fisherman's Memorial. Mm-hmm. And we're a small grassroots committee and a group of Juneau residents that basically got together back in the early 90s, late 80s. We had, the community had lost several fishermen, and you know, it was a dangerous industry. That was before the individual fishing quotas, and things sort of slowed down a little bit. And basically, several of us wanted to do something, you know, put together something to memorialize the commercial fishermen, not just the ones lost at sea, but those that this was their business, this was the industry. And those that lost at sea also didn't have a place. You know, a place where family could go and grieve and be remembered. So we started meeting, and Bruce Ryrock was our president of the board, and the original members were Patsy Weber and Elsie Osborne, Robert Millard, and myself. And all of us... you know, Robert Millard had lost his brother at sea, and they never found him. And Elsie's husband, my father-in-law, had died on his vessel. And I had lost a cousin and several friends. And Patsy and Fred Weber had lost their son.
Wow.
And so we started working, trying to, you know, get letters out to the community, so what kind of support we had, and we had tremendous support. It's a lot of good neighbors. And before I came here, I went back and just looked at a lot of the donors, and it's amazing. When you talk community, that's what that wall's all about.
Wow.
It's a lot of community. There are 185 names engraved on the wall, and those with a star were those that died at sea.
Okay.
And there's also a brass plaque there with a lot of the founding donors. And one of the top donors on the top of that list is CBJ. And when we first started working on this, the it was Giorgio at the where the Twisted Fish
mm-hmm.
basically had they contributed access to the property. It's on that on their property, and we the property was in that whole shore side was pretty poor shape, and we basically had a lot. Oh boy, let's see. Gold Bell, that was Chicanos, a lot of folks, businesses contributed. We put in pilings, we shored up that whole shore side. When they were trying to put in some additional development down the way, it actually, our improvements actually saved some of that shoreline. It there was a lot happening there. Our first mm-hmm. blessing was actually right where the ferries used to come in,
really?
No longer there. But I think that first blessing of the fleet was 1992, and I think our boat was one that was blessed. May have dropped the wreath. And,
So, Linnea, is this rooted in some other tradition elsewhere? I'd never heard of it before coming to Juneau.
We actually did a lot of research on it before we settled on this design, and we worked with a local architect on that design. But we were studying several various, celebrations around the country and how different communities remembered their fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Some had bells. They rang the bell for each name. Some had walls. Some had other monuments, other celebrations. And we wanted to put something together that was unique to Juneau.
Mm.
And when we started the fundraising to build around that design and bring the granite in, we were supported by a lot of community members just out of their own pocket, out of a lot of the businesses, and not just seafood businesses, although seafood business was very generous.
Mm-hmm.
We received contributions from, accountants, from attorneys, from the local native, regional, and village corporations.
Mm-hmm.
We received them from electric or ALMP, several of the local, companies.
Really
at the end of the day,
the mines too.
Mm-hmm.
See, at the end of the day, I think a lot of it just has to do with remembrance and the need to honor people that, for themselves and also for the effect that they had on the community.
Mm-hmm.
That fishing is more important here than a lot of folks, including myself, at one point even realized.
Yeah, that's very true. Huh. I'm just curious if in other parts of Alaska this happens as well. If there
Dutch Harbor has
something. Okay.
I believe Kodiak does.
Okay.
Pelican has a little fishing, little area.
So does Petersburg.
Petersburg. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sitka has a wall where they bought bricks.
I should go back home to my town of Valdez and start one. All my family are commercial fishermen as well. Huh. So this weekend is going to be the same as every year, or is there a little bit different program?
The program varies slightly, but the same gist is always there. It's the blessing of the fleet, which I'm sure is a centuries-old tradition in one form or another.
Yeah.
And this is the 20th anniversary, I believe.
Yeah.
This year.
Are we going and doing
20
it?
20 years.
Yep.
And, there are some folks that have continuous participation. Risa Wilson throws open the Twisted Fish for a community brunch that follows the blessing. The City of Juneau Pipe Band, which formerly the Stroller Whites, come and contribute their beautiful music. They play Amazing Grace, and they'll do Amazing Grace again this year, and Hector the Hero, and other assorted tunes. The U.S. Coast Guard Color Guard, the 17th District, usually right on hand. They've been there most of the years. And with the U.S. Coast Guard Liberty on watch.
Cool.
The Girl Scout Cadet Troop 4026, co-leaders Melanie Coleman and Tina Strong have been involved several years, and they weren't before they were cadets.
Okay. Well, and it's their 100-year anniversary, too, the Girl Scouts this year.
And they've been very involved with us for several years. While my daughter was still a Girl Scout when she was Brownie and Junior, she participated, too. So, we've had a lot of folks. We've had a variety of distinguished guest speakers. Our first guest speaker was Governor Walter Hickel.
Whoa.
This year we have Governor Sean Parnell and his wife.
Nice.
We've had other folks?
We had Dr. Sobolev in the past. That was an interesting year. There's a variety of folks that come down and speak. So, I mean, it's quite an event, and it's good to go and get the perspective. And other participants, you know, beyond the Coast Guard or the fleet itself, I mean, each boat will come by and become individually blessed, which requires some tricky maneuvering to get in there, to get close enough to have access.
And let's talk about that, because that visual, I mean, not having ever seen this, so any boat in Juneau or Southeast, or you just show up and pass by?
Any commercial fishermen, and we've even had a few non-commercial fishermen, the harbor boat show.
Okay.
on the ocean, any luck you can get is worth it, so go for it.
That's right. We've had a few that finish off loading at Taku Smokers and just join us.
Nice.
Yes, it is, and just join, get in line, and go
like
by.
Like a parade.
Going to the parade. We have local clergy or spiritual leaders that participate either in the invocation or the blessing. One year we had a Navy chaplain come in.
Yeah, fun.
And he actually had a little color that year. He tossed water across each bow or tried to, and everyone that was standing behind him was soaking wet at the end.
Oh, no.
Of that.
Nice. Now, both of you got involved for different reasons. Carl, you're a newer board member now, right?
Yes.
You just started with the Commercial Fishermen's
Memorial. Have I been on for a year yet?
Yeah, I think you're at your first year anniversary.
First year anniversary, roughly.
Does it take a lot of time? Do you guys have meetings a lot? Did you have a...
Meetings are fairly infrequent. This is the primary event, so there's the lead-up for that, of course. But otherwise, it's just management. And Bruce Weirach does an incredible amount for the organization, taking care of that.
Oh.
So anyone who's interested, you know, by all means, you know, get in contact. And it's not a huge commitment, but it certainly does take the time that it takes when it decides to take that time,
Right
about now.
April, May.
And one of the changes in the last few years, in addition to our annual blessing, there's been a lot of changes up in the along the harbor, too, and that we've been involved in. And we're not sure what the future holds.
Really?
We're at some crossroads. We've been trying to work with the city. The current assembly hasn't been as supportive as those in the past. Mm. We basically, they have the different design options for the current cruise ship berths, the one that they have put forth will basically change the whole blessing. I mean, we will lose our ability to go up and drop the wreath and, close proximity. We will no longer have the open access to the wall. And in addition to that, there's a lot of questions around the safety of this current design. The Harbor Office is working with us. We're encouraging, the community members to weigh in, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we don't know what the future is going to hold. This may be one of the last blessings as we know it down here.
So it
depends. There's a lot of folks that have raised some really valid concerns about the current design, and again, we'll see where it takes us. I know that the, the Planning Commission also raised some issues, has taken our concerns seriously on the safety side. And it may also impact the ability to, deliver our fish, too, which could have a negative fiscal ramification to the community as well. And when you're looking at, I think, the first wholesale dollar amount of like 2009, I think was $39 million on our seafood product just from Juneau. I think one of the 35th more valuable seafood ports in the nation.
The 35th, is that what Juneau is?
It depends on which year you look at.
Okay, I've never heard that before.
2009, we were 38th, and I'm not sure where we were in 2010.
Okay,
but the value of the seafood, and then of course we have approximately 260 permit holders that are based in Juneau that live here, buy their groceries, their fuel, hardware. They do a lot of local, and their kids go to school here. We're a significant population in this community and make significant contributions. One of our past guest speakers was Peter McDowell, and he actually shared quite a lot of interesting statistics, I may,
Yeah, go ahead.
It was a few years ago, but basically of the 200, this is 2009, the 256 active permit holders and 441 crew members, they earned over $18 million from all of their fisheries in 2009. Add 129 Juneau residents who work in the local processing sector, and over 800 Juneau residents earn money directly from harvesting and processing. And when you say Juneau residents, I mean they have families too. Our local processing sector is substantial and growing. In 2009, 430 individuals earning $4 million in wages.
Wow.
And in addition to that, Juneau is the operations and service and supply center for both residents and non-resident harvesters and processors, focusing on the Taku River, Lynn Canal, Chatham, Icy Straits, and other nearby fisheries. We support a strong group of, you know, professionals and other businesses serving our industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's impressive. The numbers are impressive.
Of course. Do you feel like people question this? I feel like the seafood industry here, I mean, I've had ASME on my show, and it seems like everybody's on the same page. That
I don't think people question it as much as I think it's more of the silent industry in Juneau, and folks forget about it. And they forget we're part of the visitors, you know, industry too, tourists. I mean, how many visitors don't come? I mean, when they come to Juneau or come to Alaska, Anchorage, wherever they're at, they rarely leave without enjoying some Alaska seafood.
Of course, buying it or taking it back with them frozen. Or
yes,
very good point.
So those 185 names on the wall help make that possible, and they fished, you know, in different places around, you know, in Alaska. So most of them, you know, fished out of Juneau, but there are some that fished out in the Bering Sea. They fished in the Gulf.
It's a very dangerous career.
Yeah.
Right?
And some just, you know, they fished their whole lives and they passed on land, you know, after they retired. They still made that contribution.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So fishing has shaped both your lives. Carl, how have you been impacted? It sounds like your grandfather fished for 60 years, right?
Yeah, and Dad too, from, I guess, a little bit before I was born, so early 80s through early 90s. And so, I mean, the most direct impact was food on the plate, not necessarily fish, but it came from fish one way or another. Also meant that Dad was out of town an awful lot. He wasn't there when I was born, but apparently he woke up at exactly the same time in the morning and hauled anchor and came in straight away without any directive to do so. I always like that story.
That's a good story. Nice. So would you go out in the boats in the summertime when you could?
I never actually fished with my dad. I never got to a point of being truly old enough to be worth, you know, the effort slash risk that it would take, I think. My first real fishing experiences was going out with my grandfather when I got to college. And I was lucky in the sense that he was fishing mostly because he wanted to at that point, not because he had to, which meant that you still got up and started fishing at 4 a.m., but that's when he was going to be getting up anyway, being a man of that age. And so we could, you know, toddle off and call it a day at around 4 in the afternoon, whereas, you know, if we were trying to live, it would be a much, much harder experience. He would keep going a lot harder. And so I got to see sort of the happy, wistful side of trolling, which was nice, but also just an awful lot of fish.
Hey, so he fished till the end then.
Yeah.
He built his own boat, too. It was the first time I went commercial fishing at 18, was with Carl's grandpa.
Grandpa had three boats, and he built the last two. One he sort of oversaw, the construction of number two, but the final one he made entirely by himself. It was a 54-foot handmade wooden troller.
Wow, 54-foot.
It's
lightly.
Beautiful. It's lightly. It just kind of bobs along.
Lightly,
yeah.
Twin screws.
Yeah, and diesel 671s. I mean, this thing was maneuverable.
Where is that?
It's out in Pelican.
It's in Pelican. Huh. I had her on my show. What's her name, Susan? Her name is Deb Spencer.
Deb Spencer.
Yeah, she was on the show.
She's a very good friend of ours. Yeah.
Before, and she has the scow.
Yes. I'm actually wearing a scow shirt.
Oh, no way.
At this point, yes. It says Fish and Chicks.
She was in business, actually, with Carl's grandfather.
Yeah, I heard the story last year when I was out there, and I didn't realize that was your grandfather. Wow.
Grandfather built that scow, and Deb and her husband, Keith, have been running it since taking it over from Ginny Porter, and that's another good example of community, is that, you know, Pelican has suffered terribly in the last couple of years, and the scow is, you know, short of having them flown over from here, the only source of groceries for most of the year.
Yeah, can you believe that?
And that, you know, in large part, I feel like the community exist to the degree that it does because the scow is there to enable people to live. And that's what fishing does.
Yeah, yeah. And for those who don't know what a scow is, yes. Which I didn't know what it was, but Carl?
Think of a barge with a house on it for fish buying.
Yeah, and it's all girls in this one, right?
It just happens to be. I wouldn't say that that's a policy, but it has worked out that way and worked out very, very well.
It's a competitive advantage.
Yes, and there's no particular desire to change it.
Yes, scow girls. I thought about applying to be one. It's a fun time.
It's
It'd be hard work, though.
Wonderful hard work is what I hear, yes.
Well, cool. And Linnea, any last stories? We're kind of wrapping up this hour, but any message you want to give or people that are out there that want to get involved or
yes,
come out this weekend?
Please come out this weekend, Saturday, at the waterfront in front of the Twisted Fish. It's right between the tram and the Twisted Fish. We'll
okay.
all be there. And 10 a.m., the service starts. Come a little early. We usually have flowers available at the table. And so after the blessing, basically folks usually throw those across out
nice.
On the water or they place them in front of the wall and come down. We usually, as we call the names, we encourage family members and neighbors and friends to come and walk down and view the wall. And come down and put your flower down in front of their name, you know, if there's someone there you want to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And but come and join us.
That'd be great. And then there's community. It's a free breakfast
it's
afterwards.
A community
That's
brunch
great.
Hosted by Risa. And we're very appreciative mm-hmm. of that. It's a nice closing to a wonderful event. And, you know, if the event doesn't take more than, you know, usually about 45 minutes.
Okay.
And start to finish, sometimes a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
The weather's nicer.
Yeah.
It's colder. It's a little shorter. But, yes, please come down and join
okay.
us.
Great. Linnea Osborne and Carl Broderson, both members, board members of the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial, talking about the blessing of the fleet. And for those, another maritime-related event will be the Maritime Festival next weekend, the 12th. And actually, our organization is helping to organize that. So you can come out on May 12th from 11 to 5 and sample marinade and eat fish from Azmi and Taku Smokeries and do canoe races. So it should be a fun time. That's next Saturday, the 12th. So. Thanks to everyone listening tonight on the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrienne Lopez. I'll be back next Thursday night with the next show. Thanks again.
Resources don't belong to a corporation, they belong to everyone.